On this episode of the Rad Season Show, I'm joined by former pro skater, Dirty Sanchez TV star turned vegan chef, and extreme endurance athlete, Matt Pritchard. When I was growing up in the UK and skating around London and the rest of the country, you'd always hear of Pritch, and he was one of the leading skaters in the UK scene at the time. He was hanging out with mates, skating, pranking each other, which turned into the skate video Pritchard versus Dayton. Jackass in the US had just come out at the same time, which led to MTV reaching out to the boys to produce a British version, and Dirty Sanchez was born. Sanchez was so successful, it spun into three series, a movie, a number of other TV shows for Dayton and Matt. 15 years of absolute mayhem incurred after that, taking the show on the road, doing live gigs around the UK. The years of partying took its toll on Matt, and he'd had enough by 2014 and he left. With some money he saved up, he set up the Sleep When You're Dead tattoo and barbershop in Cardiff. He later came across the film Cowspiracy and instantly became vegan after watching it. When he was younger, he trained as a chef and was looking for vegan recipes and saw a gap in the market for a funny vegan cooking show. This turned into the Dirty Vegan cooking series, which aired on the BBC. At the same time, he was running, he was doing half marathons, which turned into full marathons, and then Ironman and triathlons. Taking it from one extreme to another, Matt was looking at these gnarly endurance challenges and has accomplished crazy feats like doing 30 half Ironman events in 30 days, run across the Atlantic for 52 days. We're going to be talking about all his partying days and how he switched from becoming a pro stuntman to an extreme endurance athlete. All the physical and mental determination it takes to do these kind of epic challenges. Be talking about being a vegan and loads more stuff. Let's jump into it. Hey, Matt, how are you, man?
Yeah, good, man. I just woken up. it's unusual for me. I'm normally up at like stupid o'clock, 4 o'clock. I did get up. I had some food and then I went back to bed and I literally just woke up at 12:30. I said, shit, I got to do this rad interview. So,
excuse me. So are you normally up like pretty early then? Or
I'm normally like 4 a.m. or something like that.
Is that like sort of out of habit or like getting up early to train and kind of?
No, it's just I'd like to in the winter, I'm sure I struggle with SAD. Well, I know I do. My missus says I do. A lot of people do. I can't stand the winter. But summer, it's just great. But I just like to get up, go out, do stuff, maybe go up a mountain, go for a walk, go to the gym, just do stuff. Because it's just the best time of the day. It's quiet, it's peaceful, there's barely any humans around, and it's just absolutely beautiful. And as the summer comes along, it's lighter and still quiet, and it's just the best. So just get things done in the morning. I come home, I'm fresh, I'm ready to go, breakfast, and this is just before everyone else has woken up, and then I'm ready for my day then.
Nice, man.
But at the moment, I'm just going through a patch of
you're over in Cardiff, right? Are you? That was where you grew up and where you were born, and are you kind of close to sort of where like where you grew up? Or
I've been in Cardiff 49 years now. March I'm 49, so I haven't really moved far away from where I was born. I've sort of lived in and around where I am now. But you know, the good thing about Cardiff is I've got everything I need. You know, I've got the city for restaurants and go at nightlife and stuff. And then 40 to 45 minutes north, I've got the best mountains, like Brecon Beacons National Park, doorstep. So you've got that. And then to my left, you've just got some of the best beaches, which is like 20 minutes away. So I've got everything I really need in one place. And I think that's the good thing about living in Cardiff.
Yeah, I was in Swansea for 3 years. I was studying over there, and yeah, it was amazing, man. It's kind of like having the Gower so close by and Mumbles and everything, and yeah.
Yeah, it's just good times. Mumbles is nice, isn't it?
Yeah. That was cool. And man, I'd love to kind of I guess jump back into how you got into skateboarding and like where that all began. And
yeah, I mean, the Cardiff, I was 15, hanging out on the streets, doing nothing as you do when you're younger, like just doing sod all, just hanging out on the streets with some friends that you have. And one of them had a skateboard, and I started having a go in it, and I really enjoyed it. But I wasn't allowed to have a skateboard because my mother didn't like it. And she thought it was too dangerous. So it just took me a while to constantly persuading her to let me have a board. And at the time, I was a milk boy, and I had a paper round in the morning and the evening. Mm-hmm. So quite a bit of work, really, for somebody my age. But there's a lot of kids don't really work. Well, life just changed now, didn't it? But if I was making a fortune, I was making hardly anything. But it was money, and I learned then that if you needed something, you have to work. So, and then my mother said, yes, you could. So it took me a fucking weeks to save this money up to buy a board. And I bought a Vision Psycho Sticks, Pink Slammers, can't remember what trucks they were. And I just, that was it. And I just didn't look back.
And were you just kind of like, would you just try and skate as much as you could, right? You try and go out every day.
Christ. Looking back, what my first love was definitely skateboarding. I did not stop. All I did, day in, day out, I'd wake up in the morning, I'd skate all day. Because you had so much energy then, and you do so much excitement, so much energy, and you were just. And I had the board. That's all I did until it got dark. Skate every spare moment of the day. I just skateboarded, and that's all I did. And that's all I was interested in. I did not care about anything else. Just skateboarding. And then when the summer holidays came, if it was raining, I'd go and find an indoor area, skate, and this little square. Nothing there, no ramps. Just skate in this little square spot because there was no water on it all day.
Were there mates in school that were skating as well, or did you kind of meet them outside, like skaters outside school?
I mean, we were classed as weirdos in school back then, being a skateboarder. You're an outcast. There's one guy called Nolan, who I was friends with for years. He was a skateboarder as well. And that was it. Just two skateboarders in school. Nowadays, don't think how many skateboarders.
That's crazy. I remember with us, it was like, I don't know, maybe there was like 5 in out of 80 in the year or something. And it's kind of like, yeah, you're a bit of a, you're a weirdo, and you kind of like put to, like, what are these guys up to, you know? Like, shouldn't they be kind of, you know, playing rugby or like doing, I mean, I was like doing like team sports as well, but it was kind of like, didn't really fit in. Strange.
I did rugby, but I did rugby on the weekends as well. It didn't last very long. I was more interested in diving in the mud than actually playing the sport.
Yeah. And when did you, like, I don't know, I guess with the stunts, were you kind of were you filming like each other and your mates like right early on when you kind of got into it and like learning new tricks and stuff like that? Or did that come later?
Well, filming?
Yeah, and kind of...
It was a guy called Matthew Dyer. He was a BMXer because we used to get on with the BMXers in Cardiff. We were all like good friends. And he had a video camera, and he used to not first of all, but I can't remember how old we were, but we were still quite young. And he bought the camera, and he had filmers. Still to this day, he's now got like old, really, really old footage of us when we were younger. And it's great. Really? People asked to do documentaries on me or TV companies, oh, I'm driving your own footage of yourself, then Denny comes to the rescue all the time. It's like, you know, he's got it all. So it's just great to have it, to look back at those times, because, yeah, they were good times.
That's cool that he kept everything. And would he like sort of mix music into it as well? Like, and
well, he made,
just like just raw, like
he used to make videos called, they were called half and half, because it was half BMX, half skateboarding, and then yeah, half and half two. And you know, they made those videos of, and we all had sections each, and you know, we got them filmed for our sections, and this is a long time ago, man. This is, you know, the kind of stuff people will do today. But no, yeah, I mean, obviously the quality wasn't up to much. But yeah, fun, man.
And when did you kind of start like with the sponsors? Did you look for sponsorship, or did like someone approach you?
No, I at City Surf for the skate shop in Cardiff, Jono, who owned it, he was nice enough to sponsor me. I get trade price on all this, on everything that I wanted, so that was a great help, because as you know, skateboarding isn't cheap. And, you know, I wasn't made of money, neither was my parents. Well, my parents wouldn't pay for it anyway, because you know, it's my hobby, it's my thing. You know, I did have a job. So it was nice to get trade price on boards and stuff. So
yeah,
they always helped me out. They were really good. And then I think it's when I went to Raglands, to a skate comp in Raglands, and I won the comp. I don't know how, but I used to shit myself every time I entered a comp. I was just a bag of nerves. And I just did not land, didn't fall off any trick. And I was like, whoa, what's going on here? In my head.
Would you just put pressure on yourself, you reckon, or are you like?
Well, just nervous, man. Loads of people looking. I always got nervous. And I just landed everything. And then they said, oh, winner is Matthew Pritchard. And I said, well, I've got a fucking skate comp. And then that's when Alvin from Phase 7, he was there. And he sent Alan Rushbrook up to me. He goes, see that guy up there, he wants to sponsor you. And I was like, wow. And then there was Carl Shipman from, he was running for Deathbox at the time, which is now Flip. Mm-hmm. And Jeremy, he came over to me and said, oh, Jeremy Fox wants to sponsor you. So I had Flip, Deathbox then, was Deathbox or Flip, you'd say. And I had Alvin from Phase 7. So I had these two, I had to make this choice. And I was like, oh, I didn't want to be bad, and I didn't want to let each one of them down, because I thought, oh, I'd be a cunt if I didn't let them down. And anyway, I worked with Alvid, and he sponsored me with Consolidated Skateboards first. I think Consolidated 8-Ball clothing, wheels, Etney shoes, and that was it. Then I was every month I'd get this huge package full of stuff, and it just felt like Christmas Day every day.
That's so good. Every month, sorry. And what was the requirement? Were they like looking for you to get parts, or is it, you know, like were you doing more competitions and stuff around then, or?
No, you just do your best to try and represent the companies that they've sent you. So, you know, I go to competitions more often. I try and get more coverage in magazines and stuff. Yeah. And I think when people know you're sponsored and you're good, I think you've got more chance than phoning you up to go and do photos for magazines. And that's what happened, really, until he said, oh, we're gonna start a British company called Panic. And we'd like you to be the first pro. And I was like, well, pro skateboarder. Christ, I never thought that would ever happen. And I was like, yeah, cool. So I turned pro for Panic under the Phase 7 banner. So I was still getting all the clothes and all that kind of stuff. But then Panic Skateboards. And then Pete Fowler did my first graphic. And you know, all the other Butch Shire, Connor Kennedy, all them, they all start, they all joined in as well. And that's mm-hmm. when Panic started, and then Blueprint started, and then it just all went from there.
Yeah. And how was the scene back then? I mean, was it relatively small and kind of, it was sort of like growing?
Yeah, it was. I mean, throughout the UK as a whole, I'd say it was. But it was good back then, though, because it was just, there was just a few of us that would always go to the skate comps, and we'd all that. And that was just our excuse. A skate comp was basically our excuse for all of us to get together, hang out, and have a weekend together and have a laugh. You go skating all day Saturday. We'd all go out. We'd all find out who's going where then at night. We'd all get pissed up, act like dickheads. Next morning, everyone will be hungover, and then the comp would be there. And it was just a, you know, it wasn't like shitloads of people. It was just a nice group of us and a few people spectating. And the only reason people knew about these comps was just from magazines, from mm-hmm. Rad Sidewalk and stuff. Because, you know, they'd have the, well, I'm going to go there. And then everyone else would see, I'm going to go there as well. So that's how you got to know back then. And rather than via social media or off phones or whatever it is these days.
Yeah. And were you touring as well? Like, did that kind of start? Were you doing like UK tours, or were you kind of going over like around Europe or anything? Or
we did, we did the first Panic and Blueprint tour was, God, it was, oh, it was years ago, but it was the first one. We had a minibus. We were staying in travel lodges. It was like, yeah, we're all on the bus. We're all young. We don't care. And we're going all over the UK doing demos at different skate parks and stuff. And I can't remember where it was, but we were up north somewhere. And we all went out on the piss, and I come back. And when we come back, the people who owned the hotel had been in our, we found out they'd been in our rooms because the boy had been smoking weed and the collar had smoked some weed. We were trying to see if they could find drugs anywhere or anything. And so I was pissed up, and I was like, oh, fucking sure, I'm fucking coming in the rooms or not there. So I grabbed pillows, blocked the bogs, flushed the chains, flushed the baths, fucking toothpaste all over the walls. I literally just flooded rooms because the water wasn't going anywhere. It was just going all over the floor. And just upturned, just basically smashed the living daylights out of our rooms. Right, I was young then, right? I'm not.
Different times.
But it was a mess. It was water everywhere. The rooms were flooded. And then next thing you know, the police were called. And Alvin, who was the team manager for Phase 7, he was like, what the fuck have you done? Like, what? We're going to have to go pack your stuff. We're going to have to go. Could you jump in the minibus to get to the next travel lodge before police come? So once we got in the minibus,
Were you like climbing out the window and stuff, or is it?
Oh, we were just fucking, I go just all of us just ever laughing and giggling. Alvin was not laughing and giggling. He was, you know, he knew he had the company credit card. And we got in the minibus, and as we were going out, the coppers came in. And then next thing you know, the coppers are Alvin's like, the coppers behind us, the coppers chasing. There was about, must have been about 5 cop cars, 2 police vans, and above us a police helicopter, all chasing us the other way. Alvin's trying to outrun the mini bus. And we're like, oh man. And he's like, you are in a lot of trouble. And I was like, oh fuck. But anyway, we got pulled over, and they've arrested every single one of us. We had some of the foreign riders in the bus as well, Mike De Geers, somebody else, and then they put us in the back of a police van, took us to Wakefield's police station.
Yeah.
We were all in different things, and apparently I was next to some guy, and we were all singing in the cells. we're not getting out. We're not getting out. Alvin's just in the room. It's well going. I'm going to kill him. Anyway, they let us out at 4 a.m. And I got Alvin was just silent. Everyone was silent. And I thought, oh, God, they're all going, you're in trouble. And then he drove, and he drove straight to Wakefield train station. I said, Alvin, what are we doing here? He went, you are going home.
I was like, you can't put it off.
You're going, what do you mean I'm going home? You're going home. I'll get you your ticket. You're going home. I've had enough. I can't handle you. So I had a bottle of whiskey in my pocket. I pulled the whiskey out and screwed the window. Go. Cheers, everybody. And they all wound him up even more. He was like, fuck. And anyway, they waved me off on the train. I went back to Cardiff, and they carried on with the rest of the tour. I remember turning up the City Surf, and they were like, what are you doing now? You're meant to be on tour. And I said, well, and I told them the story, and that was that. But a lot of, good memories, man.
And when did you start working for Globe? Because you were the team manager, weren't you? Was that for, Double Overhead? And
yeah, that was for Brad Hockridge from Cardiff, the surfer. He asked me, because he was very, I knew him anyway, and he knew the guys at City Surf really well. And he was in the shop, and I always thought, I'm getting older now. I'd like to do something which, because I'm not really good at anything else apart from, I know skateboarding, I know the industry, I know the people in it. And he said, well, there's a job here for you. You're team manager for Globe Skate Shoe. I'm going to be distributing it. Do you want it? And I was like, I got to take this, man. I've got to take this opportunity. So I was like, yeah, I'll do that. So I just started working for Brad at Double Overhead, Brad was just amazing, man. He was just, best boss. He's really laid back. He understood my situation, that if I needed to have a day off to go and do something skate-wise or whatever, and he was cool. Nice. So, I had to get a team together. And we had a really good team. We had some good times, and we went to some good places, did some good demos. And it was about 3 years there. Okay. 3 years there, and then that's when the Project versus Dayton thing started gathering speed towards the Dirty Sanchez thing. And then when Dirty Sanchez happened, that's when I left them. But I had 3 or 4 good years in Double Overhead, and it was just such a laid back place to work. Like, if they were surf, Brad would be like, right, come on, everyone, let's go surfing. That doesn't happen in many jobs, does it? No. It was just cool. It was cool, really, really cool.
And when did you and Dayton come up with the concept then for that initial show for Pritchard versus Dayton? I mean, were you guys sort of thinking about? I mean, you were always kind of messing around anyway, and you thought
but that's all we used to do, mess about. And it was Can't Kill Yourself would just come out by McGear and stuff. I don't know why, we weren't copying it, and they weren't. Nobody was copying one another. I think it was just skateboard humor. And, Dent had a camera, Dikey had a camera. And we just thought, well, let's just make this, let's make a skate video, which has a lot of good skateboarding in it, but at the same time has a bit of fun in it of what we're getting up to. So that's what we did. Pancho was in there because he was always falling asleep when we were messing with him. He was in there because he was just an absolute lunatic. Me and Dave just messing around with one another. And it was just, we made the video, and then it just went crazy. There was a lot of people talking. We used to take it to trade shows and show people to the promo part of it, just to get them have a little taste. And a lot of people really like that taste, and they really wanted to see the whole video. And it was the most hyped skate video of its time, I think. And then when it did come out, we sold quite a few copies. And then lo and behold, Jackass happened in America around the same time. And a talent scout for MTV wanted to wanted to do the same kind of program in the UK. So I think we fitted the bill, and that's how it all happened.
And I mean, like, did you kind of imagine how that would blow up? And
no.
or were you just like, you know, like I'm having fun with my mates, and we're just going to kind of keep on doing what we're doing? And
it's just, we were just having fun, and it's just, we didn't expect that to happen. I mean, even when we had the meeting with MTV and they said, oh, we'd like to do a show with you, we only thought there was going to be one show, and that was it. We never knew that there was going to be second series, third series,
yeah,
a movie. And me and Dayton did another two series at other shows, and it was, we just did not expect that at all. But it, you know, people seemed to have liked it, and it just went absolutely crazy. But it just went 15 years of absolute mayhem after that.
And now, sort of like looking back, I mean, like, do you have any sort of like moments where, you know, like that was like sort of like the funniest time or the funniest sort of season? I don't know if it was sort of like the beginning, maybe more so than kind of like the end of it, or were you guys just having a good time throughout of it?
We just had a good time throughout all of it, really. It was fun, man. It was just really good fun. I mean, it was a laugh. It was a really good laugh. I mean, you get paid to go and have fun. When you're that age and MTV says, here's some money, go and have a laugh, you mate. It's hard not to like, really. And that's exactly what we did. They gave us money and we just went wild. And it was just the dream, wasn't it? It was literally living the dream. But, you know, we started off as mates, and trust me, man, money, fame, and all that kind of stuff, and what we were doing, and the booze, the drugs, that it is a recipe for disaster. It's as great as it is, the further it goes down the line, the more it just gets a bit, yeah. It was, you know, well, like, it was the perfect fucking rock and roll story. Absolute perfect rock and roll story. We had them.
Was it pulling you guys apart, you reckon? Like, as it was sort of like.
Yeah, it was pulling. We were slowly but surely ripping each other's heads off. We were living in each other's pockets.
Yeah.
And, you know, day by day, we were tall, you know, hangovers, fucking up my way. It's just. It's a hard life to sustain and be completely happy and not argue constantly. But, you know, it is what it is. And, you know, all the boys, I can't speak for the boys, but I'd say all the boys know exactly what happened. We did all fall out. But now the main thing is we're all still friends again, and that's all that matters, really. We went. Absolutely up there. We went down there, and then we're back up there again, and it's all happy days.
That's cool. So you like, would you guys hang out now then? You kind of all...
Yeah. I mean, I'm going to the cinema to go and watch Jackass, the movie with Dink, most probably Pange and stuff on Saturday.
Nice. So,
yeah, you know, I spoke to Pange yesterday on the phone. Well, this morning, actually, I spoke to Pange this morning on the phone. I went to see Joycey the other week. So, yeah, it's good, man. You know, we can sit there and reminisce about the good times and the stuff that we did. Oh, man, I tell you what, you can sit down and go over the stuff we did, and you just have such a good laugh. Oh, man.
Off the screen. You guys used to mess around quite a bit with Pantry. Remember? Like what do you reckon was one of the funniest things that you...
Where do I start, man? I mean, Pancho generally, day to day, is just funny. You know, when I hang out with Pancho, it just cracks me up. Just little things that he does, like, nobody else would find funny, but I find funny. I see his little tweaks and his little, oh, right there, right. Open his hat, like, no, I want to be a, and he's just, you know, sticking the dildos to his hands was funny because he didn't know that he had to go put one in his mouth. shaving his hair off. Oh, man, just so many things. I couldn't pick one. There's just so many.
There's too many. And, like, when that was all sort of, well, I guess kind of coming to an end with the shows and stuff, like, around, like, that was sort of, like, 2014, was it 2015? And you were kind of, I don't know, you just wanted a break from it all and...
Yeah, it's about 2014 it was, yeah. I just called it because we sort of, we called it, me and Dave were still doing Pretty Amateur Dating live shows. We used to do Dirty Sanchez live shows for them. Joycey and Pancho's, I don't know, this is where it all went a bit wrong. Anyway, doesn't matter. Joycey and Pancho saw when I did their own thing. Me and Dayton went and did our own thing. So me and Dayton took it back to the roots, Pritchard versus Dayton, and we were doing live shows. And in the end, I was just like, oh, look, this is just getting ridiculous because me and the crowds were dwindling.
Mm-hmm.
And the stuff that we used to do on stage, and it's kind of like, hitting our early 40s, I think the last thing, you know, people want to see is a 40-year-old man on stage whacking drumsticks up his ass and stuff. And this is, I don't know. I think this has got to be the time I call a day. And I just did an email and said, look, I'm out. And just stop there then. I just found something else to do in life when I opened my shop in Cardiff.
Yep.
And just sort of concentrated on that then. And it's something I wanted to do for a while, but because I was always on the road and I couldn't concentrate on it, I sort of just kept saving my money. And then when it was time to go, then I invested in that and it took me in a different direction.
Okay. And then were you sort of then focusing on, like, well, I guess sort of like drinking less and kind of like, since you were like away from the touring, you know, it wasn't such a, like, a hectic lifestyle.
It wasn't as bad, no, because obviously I wasn't going on the road. And
yeah,
started my fitness journey 2009-2010, did my first IMR 2011. But like I said, I was burning the candle at both ends. You know, I do my training, that'll give me permission to party, blah, 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 any excuse. I was all right to go out because I'd done this.
I've been jogging today, I can go out on the lash, and it was kind of like...
Exactly, I just next hour bike ride, permission to go and party, so stupid thing to think of. But when it did get, yeah, I wasn't nowhere near battering it as much because I was on the road, but I still have my odd sessions.
And, like, was that the same sort of time then when you kind of became vegan and you sort of switched? Was that sort of linked to the exercise, do you reckon? Or it was sort of something you just...
Because I wasn't on the road, I was exercising a lot more. And I was looking into veganism because there was a lot of endurance athletes were vegan. And I just wondered why, and I thought, I'm quite interested. So I was just reading up on it and stuff. And a lot of stuff that came up saying, oh, would they watch Cowspiracy and stuff? So I was like, I have to check this Cowspiracy thing out. And so I had some kind of intention of going vegan. And once I watched Cowspiracy, I was like, wow. You know, I just thought, you know, being vegan was not eating dairy and meat. And if you actually watch that and realize what actually goes on in, really woke me up, and I just went, saw this, and the next day I went vegan straight away.
And straight
after I watched that, gone. And I didn't look back, and I said, and I'd say it's mostly one of the best things I've ever done.
Did you feel it with the exercise and with the things that you were doing? Did it take did you kind of like feel the difference? So I don't know, like a couple of weeks to like a month into that new diet.
I felt it on my body because I did lose quite a bit of weight to start with. Okay. Because I was still getting used to, you know, what I was going to replace meat with and all this kind of stuff. And I was looking on YouTube for inspiration and all this kind of stuff. But I think I just lost a lot of weight because I completely changed my diet overnight. But then slowly but surely, my body got used to it and my weight started coming back up again. But that's when I was going on YouTube and looking for inspiration, that's when I realized a lot of these vegan channels are piss boring. Like, man, but then at the same time, I saw a gap in the market. I thought, well, you know, I used to be a chef. I should make a fucking vegan YouTube channel and have a bit of a laugh with it and just sort of make these dishes simpler for your average Tom, Dick and Harry to be able to follow easily. So if they wanted to make the change to being vegan, they can find it easy. They can do it easy by following my page. So I spoke to James and Pete from the directive, and they were up for it. And we started filming a Pritchard's Proper Vegan Cooking on YouTube. And it just went, you know, just started doing really well. And then BBC saw it, and that's how Dirty Vegan started. So.
And then that turned into a second series as well, and it kind of, yeah.
Yeah, it was. Dirty Vegan just basically took over then, so I didn't have time to do the YouTube channel because I was so busy doing Dirty Vegan. I did the triathlon, the first person to do the triathlon of Wales. So I was trying to film Dirty Vegan, the first Dirty Vegan. At the same time, well, I couldn't train because I was just so busy filming. Because it was the first time they filmed a cooking show, so they were learning. First time I filmed a cooking show, so I was learning. And then it was coming up and I had to do this Circumference of Wales triathlon. And then at the same time they said, oh, BBC want to do a book on the I can't do everything. And so I was trying to do all this in life, just went from there to like there, like straight away, and it was just like, whoa. But it was great. I really enjoyed it. And the triathlon around Wales. I mean, I jumped in Penarth and then swam to Porthcawl, which was like 24 miles in the sea, and I didn't really have that much training, and then cycling around and then running. And then the show came out, and then the book was still going. And it all worked. It literally managed to that book. Got three months that book took. From starting to getting it out in time for Christmas and in time ready for Veganuary for when the show did come out, the first show.
Yeah.
We managed to get everything done. It was unreal timing.
Like when you were doing like the challenge to go around Wales, I mean, that was like 30, was that the 30 like half Ironmans, right? And you were kind of doing that?
No. It was,
was that different?
One big triathlon. So I swam to Porthcawl, cycled from Porthcawl, hugging the coast, and took an Anglesey as well up to Prestatyn, and then ran off his dyke all the way to Cardiff in time for the Cardiff half, and then I did the Cardiff half then to finish.
That's mental. Was that your idea, or was it like someone's just like...
Well, no, we were going to do something else. We were going to go and do something in Ibiza, because I had a lot of history in Ibiza doing boat parties and all stuff like that. So we were going to do something there, but the budget didn't allow for it. So we and it was BBC Wales that we were filming for, so it made sense to keep it in Wales and do something Welsh bound instead of going abroad.
Yeah. And I mean, like, where did you like, and then after doing that, like, it would just get more, it was getting more extreme, right? Like all these challenges and projects, and was that something that you wanted to do? You were like, okay, if I can do this, like let's kind of push it and try and take it a sort of step further, or you were like, I haven't done it before, it's something new, let's just give it a crack.
I mean, everything I do, I always try and take it. You know, I try and push it to as far as I can possibly push it. Whether it was skateboarding, whether it was partying, seeing how many days I could stay up and just constantly in competition with myself. And I'd also try, I'd just try and push the envelope as far as possible. And when I got into doing endurance stuff, then nothing really changed, really. I did one Ironman, and then I found out you could do a double one, so I did the double one. And then I've realized you could do a triple one, so I did a triple Ironman. That triple man Ironman consists of 7.5 mile swim, 336 mile bike, and then it's a triple marathon. So it's about 76 mile run. So I managed to do that in 39 hours. And then I did the 30 half Ironman in 30 days. And that's when I just went vegan as well. And that's when a lot of people said, well, doing what you do, I think the last thing you need to be doing is going vegan, because you already need all the minerals and all this sort of thing you need. So I thought, well, I'm going to prove you wrong, because I'm going to do it. And I did it on a vegan diet and I was absolutely fine. And Thing of Wales, and then they did the ultimate then, which is something I always wanted to do when I first started Ironman. When I heard about it, was the Decker, which is 10 Ironman in 10 days, 10-4. Wow. And there was two formats. There was an Ironman a day every day for 10 days, or there was the continuous. So the continuous, I do all the Ironman swims in one, which was 24 miles in a 25 meter pool. It's going back and forth. And then when you get out, you do a 1,120-mile bike ride in a 7-mile loop. You keep going over the time in that until you've done it. And then the run was 262 miles in 1-mile loops. And then, yeah, I managed to be just over 10 days. I did that with VK as well.
What was the most, like what was the hardest? Or were they all kind of like... when you were doing them, they were all pretty hard, right? I mean
that Decker was so hardcore, because I was riding my bike for 21 hours a day, and I'd sleep 3, and I'd wake up and I'd start again. But my undercarriage from sitting on the seat was just all my skin had come off, and I was just red raw underneath, so I had to try and keep that from getting infected. And every time I just couldn't sit down on my seat. It took me a good hour until I could actually put the pressure on top of my seat. But, I managed to do it, and it took me a while to repair myself. And then obviously the last thing that I've done recently was just row across the Atlantic. And I did that on a vegan diet as well. So to everyone out there who says being a vegan makes you weak, I think I've finally proven that it's absolute load of bollocks.
Yeah.
It makes you travel harder and makes you perform better.
And with the Atlantic, did you have you done like any kind of rowing before that? I mean, before you sort of started and thought like about that project, had you like, obviously you were running, swimming, cycling and stuff, but yeah.
No, this is the only proper bit of rowing I did was in Rugg Park Lake on the rowing boats. But I'd rowed on Concept 2s and stuff in the gym, and that's a Concept 2 that I had in my house that I used to train on for the Atlantic, because we were in lockdown and the gyms are closed. But my mate Chris Ware, who runs Warehouse Gym in Swansea and the big gym in Swansea, he let me use the Concept 2 to train with in Cardiff, in my house. So I used that, and I got Mark Whittle, my coach, who's coached me through most of my big challenges. He gave me a training plan, and I just spent hours in my house rowing. Oh, man, I tell you what, it was awful. Just sat there.
How was it with the seas? Like, did you get like any big swells and stuff?
The sea,
any scary moments when you were out there?
It was in the sea. It was brilliant. But it's just the sea was ace, because it was more fun. You're out in nature, and Yeah, we had one big day, big seas. One minute down and now literally look up and you're just covered with a wall of water. But these waves don't flop over, it's just swell. But yeah. It was still like, oh man. And then once you could you go 2 hours on, 2 hours off, which me and my skipper mate, we'd do 2 hours and then we'd swap into the cabin and the other two would come out and carry on. So when you're in the cabin, you close the door, and that noise of all those waves hitting was like accentuated by about 3 times. So when you woke up, you're like, fuck, I gotta go out there, man. Sounds like gnarly as hell. And then you'd open the door, what's it like? And they're like, oh, it's terrible. And it's just like, no.
What would you do? Are you just like strapping yourself into the boat and stuff?
You'd have a life jacket on, you'd have a strap around the waist. So if the boat capsized, if everything's all the doors closed properly, and you know, the safety was paramount out there. Like, you even when you're tired, you've got to be on it. You've got to close every lock of everything that was watertight. If it went over, you'd go over with it. So you'd be upside down in the water, then it'll flip back up again. So if the door wasn't open, go on. Water would go in, wouldn't flip up, dead. So that's why you always had to be on top of it every single time you came in and you came out of the cabin.
And you guys would be like sleep deprived as well, obviously, like kind of going through this. And
I was quite good at keeping on that boat. The other boys had a really bad, they found it quite hard to sleep. But as soon as I ate my dinner, because in that 2 hours you have to clean your wounds, because like me and Billy slept as soon as you got in the boat, just naked. It's just so the air and stuff can get to your wounds on your ass and everything.
Yeah.
And to cram your ass and you've got to clean all your cuts to stop them from getting infected. Then you eat your food. Takes a good 15 minutes to heat the food up, rehydrate it, eat it, and then try and get about an hour's kip. And then 10 minutes, you'd have a knock on the door from the boys. 10 minutes left, boys. And then you have to get all your stuff on ready. Out you go, do it again. 24/7.
Wow. And how many days did it take?
52.
Okay. And it started off in the Canaries, right? And then finished in the Caribbean? Or?
Yeah, well, it started off in Lanzarote, and then we had a bit of the crazy problem with the seat and stuff, and then we got rescued by SOS, which crashed into our boat, made massive dent in it, and then they dragged us to Fuerteventura, and then we had to fix it in lockdown, which was a nightmare, and then 5 days later, we set off from Fuerteventura to Antigua then, and it took, 52 days, and it was just, it was hard, but it was the best. That's all I can say, just the best.
And, did you start thinking about, I don't know, maybe not straight away, but what you would do afterwards is kind of get that sort of, almost that, like, come down from, I don't know, a couple of days after accomplishing it, right? And you're thinking, like, what are you going to do? Or you just thought you just had a break then? And
I did a diary every single day. I've still got it. I've literally got it on my notes. A whole diary. I've got a massive diary from the whole time out there, and I'm keeping it for a book. That's one thing I said. I have to be disciplined and write down all my feelings and everything every single day. So I wrote it, and I've got it all there, ready for the book.
That's cool.
I mean, I had 4 bad days out there where my head just went. I just go quiet. And I said to the boys, if I go quiet, just don't worry about me. I'm just I'm just finding it hard. We all did, and you've just got to try and make sure that everyone's okay. I think the worst thing to do is to think of the size of the challenge and how long it's going to take until we get to the other side. That sort of messed my head a little bit. But there was a lot of things in my head that, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that, and I'm fucking out of your head. you see it on the boat, you get the other side. It's like it's all gone. But I mean, I couldn't stop but think that how can you swim across this? How can you do the same thing but swim it instead? Like swim from the Canaries to Antigua. Like all those kind of things are coming into my head because nobody's done that. So we were just thinking, is there a way, would it be possible to swim? And I just, yeah, there's loads of stuff. But I tell you what, I came back and I felt such a better, but I just felt so good, man, when I got to the other side. Just, you know, I'd lost a lot of weight. I was tanned. I just felt such a feeling of achievement and
yeah.
So happy. I couldn't wipe the smile off my face, man. It was just the best thing ever. And luckily, to be sharing it with three other guys who were sound was even better, because I've heard a lot of stories of people not getting on and then they get off and they don't want to see each other again. But, you know, I still speak to those, the boys that I was on the boat with.
That's
cool. So it was just all in all, it was a really, really good experience. Thankful I did it. I couldn't think of anywhere better to be whilst the world was going bonkers. And turned off all media. There was no social, there was no nothing. It was just me, nature, the sea, and all I had to do was row, and it was just beautiful, and it was just ace. And then as soon as you get back home, then you just turn on the TV, and it's like,
yeah,
bollocks.
No, the noise getting like
politicians arguing. This politician, oh, shut up! You get on the seat.
And what are you going to do this year? Have you got any plans for?
Yeah, I have. I just wanted to see how many half marathons I could run in a year, and I started. I've done five, but then I did my groin, and there's no point. There's no point in just running through the pain, because I know what it, yeah. I know it, as it'll just mess it up. So I've been doing my best to try and get it better. I've been going to hyperbaric oxygen chambers. I've been doing cryotherapy. So slowly on the mend. Nice. Fingers crossed. I should be running again next week, and then see how many more I can get in.
Nice.
Running for me, that's just that I absolutely love running, and it's so easy to put your trainers on and walk up, you run up your door. You don't need a bike. You don't need to get all this stuff on. It's just easy. Go and run. And that's...
And you can do it anywhere. It's not like you got to have the right conditions.
I don't need to go anywhere. Or if I need to go to work somewhere, I can just put my trainers on. I can run. And then I can still do what I need to do. So that's where I chose that.
Nice.
Well, it's going on a skate trip as well in beginning of March with me, Daint, Dykey, Dan Cates, and Collins, and I haven't done that for years, so it's going to be like an old school skate trip, and that'll be good.
Where are you guys going to go?
Croatia.
Okay, yeah, cool.
Albania, somewhere around by there, and just have a skate, have a laugh.
Nice.
Yeah.
Cool, man. Should be fun. And what's the best way if people want to follow what you're up to? And I'm curious about like all those notes that you were taking on the row, like when, you know, if you do put the book together, when
they're all there, man, they're all in there. Every single one of them. Twitch out SWID on Instagram, that's the easiest. That's the one I use the most. And there will be, because we, for that row, we're filming a documentary as well. It's going to be a documentary film.
Oh, cool.
Whole row. So that. Just literally the director texted me the other day. He said, man, I've just seen a little edit of it. He said, oh, it's looking absolutely brilliant. And I've seen his work before, and it's so good. So I'm looking forward to seeing what he's put together. So that will be out this year as well for everyone to see. So I'm looking forward for it. Everyone can see exactly what went on and what happened. It's like, honestly, man, doing that role was the most emotional thing I've ever done in all my life. I've never cried so much doing something. Like, just even from FaceTiming my mum and dad and my fiance before leaving, I was in tears, because, you know, I'd never done this before, and I didn't know what, like, would I come back home. And it was just, yeah, it was It was crazy, man. But it was good, though. It's good. I absolutely loved it.
Awesome. Cool, man. Matt, thanks so much for coming on the show, dude. It's been amazing chatting to you, hearing all your stories from the old skate days and Sanchez, and then yeah, everything that you're up to at the moment, man. And I hope that groin heals up and you can get back on the runs. And
yeah, it won't be long. I'll be back running again, like Forrest Gump.
Go, man.
Crack it.
Thanks for listening. As always, you can find show notes and links to resources on radseason.com/magazine. Hit us up on Instagram at radseasonpodcast. You can follow me on Ollie Russell Cowan. Until next time, thanks for listening.